5 grand here, 10 grand there, 20 grand here, you know. And before you know it, that added up to a million. And within 2.5 years, we broke even.
Wow.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. The Entrepreneur Experiment shares the secrets and systems world-class founders use to master their business, their body, and their brain. Today, we've got a really special episode for you. We have one of the OGs of the Irish internet scene, Michael Dwyer. Michael founded Pigsback way back in 1999. Only 1 in 7 households had the internet back then. So to start an internet business was ballsy, to say the least. We go through his full story from 1999 right up until their sale in the mid-2000s. He sold in 2019 for a reported 25 million euro. This is the story of Pigsback.com and Michael Dwyer. Thanks to my partner, Square. Everything your business needs, like payments, menu management, online ordering, chatting endlessly about the weather. Well, you're on your own there. Square. Everything your business needs. Almost. Visit square.com. If you're a regular listener of the pod, which I hope you are, you'll know I've been hosting the podcast from iconic offices for quite a while now, and things have gone really, really well. So well, in fact, that I'm now a member of iconic offices, working and recording from one of their spaces. This means I can vouch for the benefits it gives to any business. On that note, Iconic Offices have given me a number of exclusive complimentary day office trials for my audience. So try it out for yourself for the day. Bring your team. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description and enter Gary23, so it's Gary23, to claim your complimentary office for a whole day. It's a pretty fantastic offer. Thank you, Iconic Offices. One of the most frequent questions I get asked on this podcast is, where do I find a mentor? And I've never fully had the answer, but now I do. Introducing Mentors Work, a fully funded mentoring program designed to help your business thrive, brought to you by the Small Firms Association in partnership with Skillnet Ireland. Imagine having a series of one-to-one individual mentoring sessions, along with upskilling workshops to network with your peers and learn from experts, as well as a bespoke business plan. And the best part, it's at no cost to you. Join over 2,000 Irish SMEs and see how the award-winning Mentors Work program can help your business to thrive. Places are limited though, so apply today at mentorswork.ie. Program is fully funded until the end of 2023, so get your application in now. Michael, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Gary. Great to be here in central Dublin.
Very good. It's great to have you. You're an OG of the Irish entrepreneur scene. You were one of the originals that blazed the trail.
I think that makes me the grandfather of the Irish internet scene, does it? One of the original .coms.
I wouldn't say grandfather. OG. We'll call you the OG.
We'll go with that.
We'll go with OG. Yeah. Pigsback was and is one of the first brands that really, truly stood out, I think, in the Irish internet scene, in a consumer space.
Yeah, but there wasn't much going on at the time. You know, if I go back to the notes that I have framed at home, which were written on the back of the Irish Independent on the 25th of November, 1999, believe it or not, at that time, 1 in 7 households in Ireland had internet. And it was that narrow band, poor quality, hissy stuff. I don't know if you remember this. You're too young to remember this.
Oh, but I do, unfortunately.
It went something like, yeah. I mean, try streaming. It wasn't going to happen. Even just to download a site was very, very slow. And it was a long, long time before like decent levels of internet penetration happened. I mean, I'm guessing it took 4 or 5 years to hit 50%.
So why on earth would you start an internet company?
Well, I suppose, you know, there was that sense of the land grab and whatever not, you know, but like a lot of entrepreneurs, I'm drawn to, you know, that area of innovation, that next big thing, you know. I opened the book with a quotation from a guy called Marcel France. Don't ask me who the hell Marcel France was, but I loved the line. He said, "If you hear the sound of the cannons, walk towards them." And that's just me, you know.
Curiosity?
Curiosity, definitely, but the excitement of kind of something new, of kind of uncharted territories, you know.
What were you doing before that?
I spent 15 years in the international food business, starting with Jacobs, fabulous place, but a very traditional business on the Bellegarde Road in Tala. They were bought by a French company, Danone, and they, who had a biscuit division, obviously. And they invited me to go to Paris for 3 years, which was wonderful.
Nice.
Was, yeah, big elevation in terms of the professionalism of marketing and how we were approaching and whatever not, the use of research and marketing, all those kind of things. Mm. And 3 great years on a personal level where, you know, my wife also moved with Danone. She wasn't my wife at the time,
okay,
but became my girlfriend and subsequently my wife. And we had a couple of, we had 3 great fun-filled years in Paris.
That's magic. And travel, there's nothing like, like living in another country.
No, no, that's it. It's so critical. I'm talking to any young people, you know, indeed looking at any, you know, as we assess candidates for jobs in Pig's Back or throughout my career, you've got to see travel. You've got to see working abroad. You've got to see, you know,
it comes back to that curiosity piece.
Big time, big time. And I think it's curiosity. And in addition to that, it demands flexibility. It demands of us to go to places we haven't gone to before. Like I landed in France and found myself with a French team. You know, my French was a couple of years beyond leaving certain college. I majored in German, not French. And but still, you know, so I had to work really, really hard to get there. Then you had to sort of adapt to this very demanding haute école, grande école French team, learn about the French channels of distribution, French media, et cetera, you know. Biscuits in Ireland were, what was it, Kimberly Mikado and coconut creams.
Yeah, none of that. And they were the height of sophistication. Those digestives were the staple.
Exactly.
You'd Mikado's if you had notions about yourself.
Yeah, no, exactly. My famous strategy in Jacob was to cover everything plain with chocolate, which included Kimberly.
It's hard to go wrong, really.
Thus the launch of Chocolate Kimberly, which didn't go wrong, you know.
But chocolate Kimberly out of the fridge is my Christmas weakness.
Oh, that's my really wonderful
magic.
I mean, I can't claim to have invented it. I certainly did not. That was a biscuit that pre-existed me. But they, in the move from the old factory in Bishop Street to the new modern plant in on the Bellegarde Road, they streamlined a few things. And one of the victims of that was Chocolate Kimberly. Okay. But I used to observe the workers at Jacobs take one of the Kimberleys, the plain Kimberleys, if you like, with their little sugar coating around the mallow. They take them over to the chocolate enrober, put them in at the start, walk along the enrober.
Oh, magic.
They then get cooled through a fridge, and at the other end, they come out just crisp like that, and they put them into their lunchbox, and off they went.
Market research right in front of you.
Market research.
There you go.
It was wonderful. So I went from that to Green Isle Foods, which was based in Naas, County Kildare. They had the Goodfellas pizza brand, Dunbar Catch. And I had 4 years with them and said, look, come here, if I'm ever going to do this entrepreneurial thing, I better do it now. So
did you feel that in you? Were you always trying to think of ideas? Was that something that was deep in you?
I think so. Again, I mean, the nature-nurture thing, you know, it's definitely been in my nature I think I have an entrepreneurial nature, you know. I think it was nurtured too. You know, I'm from Dundalk originally. Dundalk was quite a business town, quite a few entrepreneurs around us who inspired us.
Frontier town.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. And, you know, that like, but that itself, it, you know, creates edge and creates cross-border opportunity. I mean, it was well known for its smugglers, but, you know, business was in the air. Entrepreneurship was in the air. And in fairness to my father, he was from a very modest background in County Cork. But he moved to Dundalk in 1960 as a young taxman to help with a new thing called PAYE. It never quite caught on in Dundalk.
I was going to say, a young man moving to Dundalk to work for the taxman, I'd say he was welcomed.
Yeah, well, he was. I tell you what, he loved his amateur acting.
Okay.
You know, that kind of endeared him, I think, to the people of the town. And eventually he set up his own business, initially promoting, you know, he was, because he was involved with the theatre and whatever not, he promoted concert acts in his own time.
Oh,
but then eventually he set up as a tax consultant. And, you know, he went through what he called himself the pains of enterprise. Nobody setting up a business, and you're learning about this too, Gary, nobody does not go through the pains of enterprise. You know, for him it was working capital. You know, what the hell is that? You don't learn about that in the civil service with your monthly salary, you know. But thankfully, he got through all of that and, you know, went on to set up quite a successful small business in the town. But, you know, he led by example, and that was very important to me and indeed to my siblings.
It's funny, so many of the entrepreneurs that sit in front of me here in the studio have that influence.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked earlier over breakfast about pattern recognition. And I'm starting to build that superpower now of pattern recognition among entrepreneurs to see the traits that I admire, the traits that cause problems. And like having someone in your family or very close to you,
yeah,
being an entrepreneur is like, yeah, I'd say 90% plus of the people sitting in front of me have had a dad, a mom, an uncle, a cousin,
yeah,
be an entrepreneur. Because I think entrepreneurship is one of those things you have to see and be exposed to it,
yeah,
to go, okay, it's damn hard, but it's doable.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I think if my move was brave, my father's move as a civil servant,
yes, yeah,
at the age of 50 to go and set up his own business was an incredibly brave thing to do, but he felt it was in him. And I suppose it was another case of now or never, you know, but definitely enterprise, if I can call it that. I mean, we tend to say entrepreneurship these days, but enterprise, you know what I'm talking about. That was a value at home. You know, we admired the entrepreneurs, yeah, in our community, you know, and good luck to them. You know, they brought opportunity to the community, you know, and if they reap the rewards, well, they deserve the best.
Exactly.
Of them, you know.
Yeah, and, I think we need a bit more of that even now in Ireland. I think we need a little bit more of congratulating people for taking the risk and actually creating value. That's what entrepreneurship is, right? Yeah, you create a value, yeah, of something for somebody.
Yeah.
How on earth did you take Chocolate Kimberly Mikados and then go on the internet and start selling things there? Because that is a massive swing.
Yeah, well, the common thread is marketing. You know, I was reading an author called Seth Godin, who I'm sure you've
brilliant.
Heard of.
Yeah, yeah.
He's quite a prolific author. But the book I was reading at the time was Permission Marketing by Seth Godin. And everything he said just rang true to me. Let's say that anyway, you know what I mean. And I said to myself, this guy really is onto something. You know, he was very anti what he called interruption marketing. And in the early stages of the internet, it was all about interrupting. It was all like, you know, permissionless interruption. A big banner would pop up and block your surfing, you know, or you'd receive emails from people that had no right to send you an email, you know. And he said, look, we need a permission-based contract, a transparent agreement that says, I give you permission. I understand what it is I'm signing up for. And I'll respect your rights. I'll never, ever rent or sell your data. So I was really taken by this and said, this really is, you know, where we should be going. And took it a step further in my own way. And we developed what we called empathy marketing principles. So empathy being that sort of, I suppose, you know, that rapport, that fellow feeling, getting under the skin of somebody and trying to give them what it is they want and only what they want. Not that intrusion or interruption.
It's funny, we still haven't got there. Like I'm amazed that book is that old. I did not realize it was that old. But when you look at internet marketing now, people are still trying to figure it out. You know, it's still a lot of like, look at this ad.
This is ridiculous. Like I've gone through the lows and highs and eventually the sale of my business, but I still feel very unfulfilled in relation to empathy marketing because I think we were onto something. We were ahead of our times. Godin was onto something. Credit to him.
Yeah, 100%.
You know? But I think people still ride roughshod over those rules, you know, they still have a big place, but eventually we all as entrepreneurs have to keep adapting and evolving and pivoting to where the money is, you know, where the revenue model is, where the profit is.
So what was your first idea? Because reading that book is great and all, but you know, the great entrepreneurs execute and take action, which you did, but how did you get from that book to sparking an idea to pick?
Yeah, back? No, that's really good. I mean, if you look at those notes on the back of the Indo on the 25th of November, 1999, what you're seeing is a draft of probably the first concept for a marketplace in Ireland. You know, on one side you'd have brands, on the other side you'd have consumers. We'd use special offers as the sort of the door opener between the two. Sign up, you know the rules. We won't ever rent or sell your data. You give us clear-cut permission, you know what to expect. We'll bring you offers from the brands that are appropriate to you, the
right.
ones you've
okay.
told us you're interested in.
So curation essentially was your idea.
Precisely that. Yeah. No, we would be the gatekeeper between
okay.
consumers and brands.
Yeah.
But we very quickly realized that, you know, nobody was going to buy these offers on the internet because there was no e-commerce. Everybody was afraid to use their literally no e-commerce, literally none. There was nothing happening. In the year 2000, HTTPS, and that it, the secure thing, was invented, but it took years for it to roll out. That was a game changer. So by 2005, 2006, 2007, you know, people were beginning to have faith in e-commerce and realize that, you know, their details were safe, provided they looked for the S. And
when did you start Big Sack? What year did you start it?
Those scribbles were November 99 and we were live by July 2000. So
how did you stay alive from July 2000 until 2005 when people started buying?
And this was the critical point. So we realized then that we, you know, brands wanted to be on the internet. The existing solutions weren't the right ones for them. So we started creating these interactive solutions for brands. So it started with, we might just have a simple competition for a brand. People would enter it by the tens of thousands. It was unbelievable the level of engagement we're getting.
So you ran competitions online?
This was the very start of it. And then we developed those into multifaceted engagement products where there might be polls, there could be coupons.
Okay.
Our grocery coupons became a huge thing. They were literally being printed hundreds of thousands every month and been brought into Tesco as people were doing their shopping and FMCG.
But isn't it mad though? Those ideas you've had are now popular again. The Dunnes voucher has reignited their whole business, argue.
They probably always were. The coupon less so in Ireland. People kind of look down on coupons a little bit, you know, which goes back to the war years and rationing. And if you had a coupon, well, that was a sign of, you know, bad
social status,
really, and social status. But our coupons were being used by the ABC ones in a big way. And the amazing thing was that in the research we did, we'd say to people, look, you know, we might get anything from a 15 to a 25%, 30% on some of the big brands, redemption rate on the coupon, meaning I printed out the coupon and then I went and used it in the supermarket and it came back through the system to us. So we asked them, what about the other like 85%? You know, unused coupons. And generally speaking, those people, the majority of them said they bought that product anyway.
Oh.
Because the very act of choosing the coupon was an act of adoption of the brand, which was incredible. So
that's
the brands were using them for their new products, you know. We developed an online research business, Empathy Research, in about 2000. Well, we started doing surveys very early and incorporating the surveys into what we now call brand features. So it started with a competition. We added a poll. We added, you know, various interactive things like the coupon. Are there, you know, I remember once Sunsil came to us and said, what can you do? You know, we want to do something on the internet. You guys seem to have the female audience. We want to get this whole thing out that there's a Sunsil, whatever your hair condition. You know, we said, well, let's get people to write a poem about their hair experience, you know. You wouldn't believe it. Like, we got 5,000 poems. That's
what?
Really deep engagement about my hair experience. You know, and some it was too frizzy and some it was too shiny and some 5,000. It was this and it was wonderful and some it was awful. But, you know, that was the level of engagement we were creating. So
how are you creating that? Because it's early days of the internet. You know, there's not that many people on it. How are people even finding you?
Yeah, well, this is, I suppose, you know, I was bringing a traditional FMCG consumer brand marketing approach to my .com.
Hmm.
So it was balls and all, really, you know. I mean, I raised 1.8 million.
Ooh, chunky.
Really chunky, yeah. It was 1.5 million punts. Now, maybe 20% of that was in services of one description or another, where we had service providers and we gave them equity or maybe part equity, part payment. But at the time, you know, I'm looking at my daughter, Nikki. She's just set up an online fashion business called Droby. But she can just plug into Spotify and then add various plugins to Spotify for rental, for appointment setup, et cetera, et cetera. Well, there was none of that. There weren't those SaaS solutions at the time. We had to build our own technology. Now, as it happened, there was an Irish company called New World Commerce who were doing really progressive things. They were super people. And we were able to build our product on the back of theirs. These days it's called SaaS. Then it was called ASP, Application Service Provider. And within a couple of years, we took control of our technology. But that technology probably cost us, I'm going to say comfortably 400,000 in the first year of first year to develop and to maintain, you know. Now, when we took control of it, eventually that cost came down dramatically. But, you know, hosting used to cost us 100 grand a year. I mean, that's unfathomable, you know, because we had to have our own setup. We had to run the setup. We had to, you know, it was just, it. You know, we may give out about the Amazons of the world, but by golly, they've made business easy, you know.
But we forget how quickly things have advanced. So that's just over 20 years ago, you know, 100 grand a year. Now me and you can have an idea for a business today. We can set it up.
Over the weekend.
Over the weekend for maybe 100 quid.
Yeah.
Probably get a lot of free services anyway. Yeah. Probably cost us nothing.
Which is good and bad because, you know, I mean, you can do those things, but so many people are doing those things, you know.
Well, water finds its level. Exactly, do you know what I mean? Things come and go very fast. Exactly. But I think the fact that the barriers are so low, it just means there's more people who are willing to give it a shot now.
Going. Yeah, 100%.
They're not prevented, or they don't have to raise massive money.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, again, like the big things. Well, so the two big users of money in year one were one, technology, and two, the brand. So I just took the attitude that if we were gonna own the space, we were gonna own the space, you know, and that it would eventually pay off. Sure, we were gonna have to wait for all this sort of, you know, internet penetration to happen. But, you know, there were enough brands out there who were prepared to pay us significant.
That was
money.
Your revenue model. They would pay to go on the platform.
And I was one of those consumer marketers, so I knew how they spent the money and I knew how to access it.
Okay.
And we thought the agencies would come to us, the media agencies, and just, you know, and book all these campaigns. Oh, surprise, surprise, that didn't happen. So we soon had to develop a direct workforce, and we did a direct sales force, I should say, to talk to the brands directly. But we were securing, you know, 5 grand here, 10 grand there, 20 grand here, you know, and before you know it, that added up to a million. And within 2.5 years, we broke even.
Wow.
Which was incredible. Now we
that
had
is incredible.
To, because we raised that first money and then the dot-com bubble burst literally as we were closing out the first few commitments. And, you know, investment sentiment, it goes in and out with the tide, you know.
Well, look at it right now, right? That's 2023, great companies can't raise. Go back 18 months. Me and you could have probably raised a million for that idea we just had in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah,
crazy.
No, exactly. And that's literally what happens. And, you know, that's also the risk of what I was doing. I didn't factor that in, but entrepreneurs don't. You know, we can have all these tidy plans, dot the I's and cross the T's. But we don't allow for these big events, the dot-com.
How could you, though? How could you know?
The credit.
You know, you can't.
The Irish property crash, the depression that ensued after that.
If you did that, you'd never start anything. If you're like, oh, Ukraine, Brexit, COVID. You can never factor in any of these things.
I think it's true. But I think at the same time, you have to probably say to yourself, one of these things may happen.
Now, perhaps, people will be a bit more cautious and a bit more aware. But if you sat at home thinking about all the things that go wrong, you'd never leave the house.
No, it's so true. It's so true. But, you know, something's going to go wrong. There's nothing surer, you know.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Leaving yourself that extra bit of reserve.
Bit of buffer. That 20%
that
buffer.
Buffer, you know, yeah. would be shocking helpful. Because when we raised our money, the plan was to spend it quickly and to raise money, of course, at a much higher valuation and to spread out across the globe to various markets really, really quickly, you know. Well, look.
God, you really embraced that dot-com era, didn't you?
Absolutely. You know, you gotta ride the wave. But and then the dot-com bubble burst, and that just put pay to all those plans. So suddenly we had to stretch the bit of cash we had. In the end, we stretched it for about 20 months instead of 6 months, you know, which was a great credit. Like, I'm not claiming the credit for that. We had a very good CFO in Rory Duggan, who was super at managing our money and just, you know, putting financial sense in the whole thing. And the whole team, everybody adapted, you know, and everybody sort of understood where we were at. And thankfully, we got there in the end. We raised more money and on we went. But it was with an entirely new set of investors.
Oh,
because that's, wow. You know, what that. You know, by that point, you know, it was one of those barren periods for investment. And the people who invested, if you like, while the tide was in, very quickly regretted their investment when the tide went out. Mm. So, you know, I think in our second round, we raised somewhere around 2 million because we brought Extra Vision, which is part of the Blockbuster group,
wow.
On board.
There's a flash. Flash in the past.
Absolutely. We brought some investors in from the UK. Enterprise Ireland came in. But in that investment round, the grand total of 3 grand came from our first stage investors.
3 grand.
That's leaving aside some family investment, you know. And that's not to be critical of those people at all. You know, we were all naive. I think if somebody in a startup has the prospect of taking on an investor group who understands all these kind of tidal movements and who is committed to following their money through a journey, all things going well, they're very lucky. They should be very, very grateful for that. And I should say that many of our original investors came back in subsequent rounds, you know.
Interesting.
Some more than others. Some didn't follow at all, you know. But that's the nature of it. You know, we ended up with 126 investors with very, very different profiles in terms of how they followed or how they didn't. And that determined the outcomes they got, you know.
How people often forget the impact of timing and luck. But even hearing you speak about that now is really refreshing, because you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what's coming down the line. You all these great plans, and then, you know, you raise the money and timing is good, and then things change and timing is bad. And I think a lot of companies get washed away with that tide of change. So it's a testament to your company that you're able to kind of get scrappy. You think all great companies get scrappy. Scrappiness.
You're so right. What was it somebody said to me back at the time? But oh yeah, it's the year of the hustler. It was one of those, you know, I think it was during the credit crunch, you know, you had to get out there and scrap for every little bit of business. You had to keep changing your business model. You had to keep the eye on the future, you know, but at the same time, you had to just keep your eye on the end of month and making those salaries, you know. So that ability to scrap, you described it as the dog earlier on, but that's critical. And, you know, I wouldn't have put myself down as somebody who was likely to have too much of that dog in me, but by golly, I found it because I had to. You know,
well, sometimes you don't know you have it until you have to have it.
That's it.
And then you're like, there is no option out. The only option is forward. There's no option.
That's right. I mean, you know, for me, it was the only show in town. That was very, very clear. You know, if this went wrong, I couldn't contemplate where that would bring me. You know, it was really nasty. You know, just that the shareholder fallout, the client fallout, just even for our members, everything. You know, it was, and you know, my lieutenants could leave. You know, and they were right to leave. You know, Gareth Lamb was one of our first recruits. Gareth went on to be head of Meta, and he's a great friend of mine to this day, you know, but he joined Pigs back in 2000. He headed up the Irish operation for a period. He went to Canada then, as we developed a licensing agreement with one of, you know, Canada's biggest companies, Bell. But a year later, another absolute unknowable, Bell agreed to a merger deal with TELUS in Canada. And as a result, they were going to take on a lot of mezzanine, expensive finance. So they said, anything that is not cash generative, we're putting a line through it. So their whole new ventures division literally had the pencil put through it. So 1 year after all the wonderful work Gareth did, himself and his wife moving over to Canada, super knowledge transfer process by our team. We moved six people over there for a period of time. A line was just put through that, you know, by people who no knowledge probably of who we were. We were absolute minnows in the process. So, you know, these things happen. So,
but the butterfly effect, you know, the butterfly flaps its wings 3,000 miles away and causes a hurricane in Tipperary.
That's it.
Like that happens. And I think, again, you can't spend too long thinking about it, but you have to be aware of, you know, sometimes things beyond your control can just happen. Someone in an accounting department somewhere is looking at a spreadsheet and you're row 37.
Yeah.
Okay, we need to delete rows 30 to 37. Yeah. Unfortunately, you're gone.
Yeah.
So you have to be aware of these things. And again, it comes back to the buffer, right? If you'd over-leveraged on that, that would have taken down the whole business.
Well, actually, the amazing thing about that was that that was a franchising agreement. You know, they were like this you know, David and Goliath, but they were actually franchising, you know, from Little Pigs back.
Brilliant.
I'll never forget the call. I mean, the call was one of the highs of the business. You know, hi, Michael, I'm Sean O'Leary. I'm the vice president of Bell New Ventures. We see Pigs back as the future of smart advertising in North America. And we agreed this massive plan. They were going to invest somewhere in the region of 30 million in launching Pigs back in Canada. But the exciting piece was that if Canada worked, they were planning to spend upwards of 200 million on rolling it out in the US. So it was a complete game changer for us. A year later, it's gone.
flip a coin, isn't it? Sometimes.
And we had hit the credit crunch in the UK soon after we raised 5 million to launch in the UK. It just, you know, again, it was like the lights going out. All our guys were coming back into us. They're saying the same people who were keen a few months ago, they've either lost their jobs, the marketing departments have lost their budgets, the accountants are in charge, there's no discretionary marketing spend, and hey-ho, we're in the discretionary marketing spend.
The words you never want to hear, the accountants are in charge now.
So, you know, we tried our best to slim it down and make it work, but it was impossible.
How did you keep going through all of this? Like, how did you keep the horizon on your eye going, right, we're still moving towards this?
It's a really good question. I think two things. You know, professionally, you know, within the business, we had no choice but to cut. And the team that survived each time, whatever it is about human instinct, you know, just knuckled down and got on with it, and we're grateful to be where we were. And we knew as well that anybody who'd been through pig's back, and this proved to really prove to work out, had got very good experience, had got very good training, and they were picked up like that in the market. Mm. Because at this stage, the digital multinationals were coming. The Metas were coming, the Facebooks as they were at the time, yeah. The Googles, the LinkedIns, the whatever, you know. And our people went on and did great things there. So, you know, we adapted in terms of the scale, and we kept adapting the business model. I mean, as I read back on the journals, which the book is based on, I see in about 2008, we first mentioned local. Pigs back local, the idea that we would do something that would be accessible to the local brands, mm. not just these big national brands who were paying us, you know, who had the marketing dollars and were paying us, you know, substantial money, but that was beginning to dry up. So we started doing these deals in London. Now, the problem with London was the guys were doing it as a content thing and they weren't getting any revenue out of it. We said, we'll do it in Ireland now, but we'll look for €300, €500 from these brands, you know, the hotels, the restaurants, the local beauticians or whatever. We soon realized, well, they didn't have much money. Next, onto the scene come City Deals. And City Deals becomes Groupon as Groupon.
It's so funny you said that. I'd literally just written down Groupon as my next question.
So Groupon appeared on the scene in 2009 as City Deals, yeah. You know, and we go, oh, hang on, they're doing things differently. They're actually taking a percentage of every deal they sell. And this seems to work really well for the merchant because they've got no marketing budget.
Yeah.
So what's the merchant getting? Well, the merchant's getting all this profile, all this traffic. And if they do the work right themselves, they'll retain these people, yeah, as new customers. That was a critical piece.
It was a wild new model, wasn't it?
Absolutely wild new model. So we looked at these guys and said, this is a huge danger to us that, you know, yeah, they've basically taken our deals model, our deals idea, but they're doing it in a better way. And I just said to the lads, listen, we're not rolling out a red carpet in front of these guys. This is our market, you know. Let's get into this market quickly. And we then pivoted from local into what we called mega deals by Pigs Back. Mm. You know what? It did what it said in the tin. It announced the arrival of something new. And very, very quickly, we were competing well in this area. Now, the numbers were small in 2010, that first year of mega deals. But they grew, and we were sort of, it was a really difficult act because we were, our old business model at its peak hit about 4 million in sales at about 90% gross margin. Imagine that, a thing of absolute beauty.
Oh, you know? The dream.
But it was all gravitating towards Facebook and Google. It was like you'll never get sacked for buying IBM. You'll never get sacked for buying Google or Facebook. And the agencies tended to want to go there as well. So we were losing out on that. And progressively, from probably about a peak in 2007, that business 10 years later was zero. So from hero to zero, 4 million to, wow, zero. And it went down in almost a straight line.
Really?
You know, so around 2000.
So what caused that? The spread over towards Google ads, Facebook ads?
Exactly.
And you weren't able to capitalize that on running your own ads then as well?
You know what? I mean, you know, also just our back was against the wall. We were cutting our team. We were, you know, it was just so, so difficult to just keep the energy in that business. It just felt like it was a falling knife. You know, it's very hard to catch.
But it's one of those businesses. It's the leaky bucket business whereby you're constantly having 100%. To fill the water.
No, that
constantly. We talked about business models earlier and I was joking about you saying whenever a startup founder says to me, I have an idea for a marketplace, I just go, whoa, Oh God, that's going to be a struggle.
But you know what we had though, as Groupon came into the market, well, we knew we had the brand, we knew we had the audience. Mm-hmm. We also knew that it was a high quality audience because anybody who joined us in 2000, 2001, 2002, they had to be ABC One. Otherwise they wouldn't have had internet access. So it was great for us to be able to go to the hotels and say, hang on now, you know, we're going to bring you the right customers. They won't be eating pizza in the room. They'll be down to the restaurant. They'll be going up through the wine list. They'll tip your staff. And this was being fed back to us. This was literally what was happening. So we realized very quickly that we had this competitive advantage, which was the profile of our audience. Soon after that, we dropped the name Mega Deals because it wasn't doing justice to that brand positioning. Didn't
tally with the, I like it,
We developed these sub-brands, luxurybreaks.ie, thediningroom.ie, the beauty lounge, you know, and accentuated this more upmarket positioning for Pig's Back. We dropped all this pinkness and became more black. We dropped Piggy points. They became Pig's Back reward points, you know. Yeah. So we took away the sort of triviality, but also tried to mark that change, you know. Our ads were, you know, embrace luxury for less with Pig's Back, you know, this kind of thing.
Well, you took a weakness and made it a strength. That's a beauty. But Groupon are this. Well, we're not going to compete with them. That's we're going to go over here and just completely separate us.
The problem with it was, again, you talked about low entry barriers. Lots of people were jumping into deals.
Yeah, oh my God. You know, the amount of deals websites that sprung up. Geez. I mean, you were buying stuff for crazy cheap. I remember buying loads of deals, Pig's Back deals, Groupon, Citibank. You buy stuff and you're kind of going, that was 20 quid. That's mental. You knew yourself it didn't make sense and it could never last.
Well, that was it. I mean, and we had to be careful too, though, because we never wanted to burn a merchant. By a merchant, I mean a hotel or a restaurant. We never wanted them to be hurt by a deal. So the deal had to make sense for them. You know, if a hotel was prepared to discount its break from 149 euros to 99 euros, knowing that they'd fill rooms that hadn't been filled before, knowing that, and we'd construct the deal so that they'd get what we call the overspend. They'd get people going in and paying full price in the restaurant. They'd use the spa. They'd play the golf, you know. So this, it was very important for us to do that because we didn't feel that our competitors had that same real care for the merchants. In fact, at one point we had a conference and we came back with a new mantra for Pig's Back, which was, we give a shit. And we put it big and bold on our walls. And we said, that is our differentiator. We give a shit. We give a shit about our people. We give a shit about our merchants. We give a shit about our consumers. You know, we were the only ones doing refunds or refunds. You know, if the voucher expired, we'd give people Pig's Back points as a means to get something back for future deals, you know. There were just things like that that made a difference. You
but I remember there were stories at the time about pizzerias going bust because they sold 5,000 deals on Groupon and they actually lost 30,000 euro on the deal.
Yeah.
Like there was multiple examples of that happening.
And you know, the Restaurant Association were very anti-deals and I understood where they were coming from.
Yeah.
But my counter-argument always was, you need to know the where, when and how of deals. You know, and we felt that was important. If we were going to have an enduring relationship with our merchants, we had to make sure it wasn't an overnight wonder for us or for them, and it wasn't going to get anybody into deep water.
You know?
So really we concentrated on, we're trying to bring you new customers. We're trying to give you profile. All of this is cash free for you. We'll pay you quickly. You know, well, we didn't know. We struggled at times to pay people as quickly as we'd like to. We eventually sold our research business to Declan O'Reilly, and Declan has done great things with it, Empathy Research, since then, and the very, very best of luck to him. He's a great operator. But that cash was fantastic for us because it cured a working capital problem and allowed us pay the restaurants, pay the hotels quicker, allowed us invest in a bit of marketing. That was around 2015. It was the beginning of the transformation. I remember, pretty sure it was 2015, you know, Black Friday. I hadn't heard of Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Giving Tuesday, all these things, but they had suddenly become a very, very big thing. But in November 2015, we did 1 million in gross sales.
Wow.
And you know what? We celebrated it. We celebrated it around the office. I got my friend, Gabriel Cooney, and Grapevine and Doc. I said, deliver us some champagne for everyone in the team. You know, this is a celebration. We've been through enough together. We deserve this. And he did. You know, 2 years later, we started doing these acquisitions because others were blinking in the market. We could have blinked. Thankfully, we didn't.
So 2017, when you say they were blinking in the market, what does that mean?
The market was overcrowded.
The deals market.
The deals market, yeah. I&M had come in with Grab One, which was, they at the time were, I&M had a big shareholding in APN, which is basically the Australian and New Zealand media outlet. They were investors in Grab One, New Zealand and Australia. So they felt they should bring this thing to Ireland. And, you know, it would have made a lot more bloody sense for them to join forces with us.
Just buy us, lads. Just buy us.
Well, just partner with us. Do something with us. You know, it would have been far more sensible. Preferably not buy us just yet, but partner with us. But anyway, look, that is what it is. They had their corporate reasons to do this. They wanted a digital story and they invested, you know, huge money in this. But they became a discounter, you know, and we'd go to a hotel and they'd say, sorry, but, you know, Groupon, Grab One, Deal Rush, Escapes, they're doing it for 2% less, 3% less, 5% less. You know, we're going, oh, God almighty. You know, and for all the progress we were making, it soon became very, very difficult to make any kind of a profit out of that market again. And the market simply was overcrowded. And as it began to plateau, that wasn't sustainable. Mm-hmm. And somebody had to blink. So Grab One blinked by the end of 2015. Distilled Media had a business called, it was boards.ie had a business, the name escapes me at the moment, but anyway, they closed as well. And we started approaching the survivors. We spoke to a company called Deal Rush and another company called escapes.ie, and we ended up doing deals with both. First with Deal Rush, and I remember going back time and time again, looking for a lower price. I was so nervous doing this deal. We didn't really have the money. We had to pay in stages, you know. But Peter Clark, who's a fascinating guy, a very interesting entrepreneur and an ex-tennis pro, he eventually agreed to a deal. And thankfully, we were able to literally bolt on the Deal Rush brand onto our platform. So it meant that the deals we had immediately made their way into the Deal Rush audience under a Deal Rush guise.
So essentially, what were you buying? Their brand and their audience?
Precisely. Precisely. And that was the beauty of it. We took no extra overhead in. Okay. His people had been diverted into a wedding business that he was involved in.
Right.
And it literally meant that anything that we did through that platform would fall to our bottom line.
Draw for revenue.
Literally it did.
Okay.
Within,
smart.
I think, 3 to 6 months, we had more or less paid for that acquisition. So we had the confidence to do a bigger deal then with James Donnelly, who was a very shrewd Australian guy from Sydney, who married an Irish girl, moved to Ireland, set up this business. And just by stealth, he did really a good job. But he was a thorn in our sides, and he knew it.
What was he running?
He was running escapes.ie and pamper.ie. So
What were that deals for hotels and
deals
spas?
For hotels and for spas.
Okay.
But he was doing it, a discount model, a cut price model. And, you know, that was very, very difficult for us to compete with, you know. So we said, look, we have to do something about this, you know. So James eventually agreed to a deal, and it took a bit longer to get payback on that one, but we got a payback on it. But, you know, then we added justgolf.ie, Treat Ticket in Northern Ireland. We made in total, we acquired 6 new brands.
Wow.
Some of them for very small money and some of them for more substantial money. But together that had a huge impact on our profitability and on our volume. So if in November, let me get this right, November 2015, we did our first million, 2 years later, 2017, we hit 4 million in November. Wow. I mean, what a transformation.
So you did a million in a month in 2015 in November.
Gross
sales.
Yeah, gross sales. So.
Okay. And then 2 years later, you did 4 million in the same calendar month.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, what a turnaround, you know. So we had...
This sounds like it's been a tough, tough business to build, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the first few years, you launch a business in 2000, you hit a dot-com crash, you know, it's a very lonely place. You know, it's a bit like the crypto lads at the moment. They must feel a bit lonely, you know, and they're nearly pariahs. And
you can give me a hug later. I feel a little lonely in crypto at the minute. All right.
But it was a bit like that. You felt like, oh, there's that Egypt in dot-com, you know, there's that Egypt in crypto, you know, so you had to survive that. And also just the constant fundraising. A friend of mine said that to me. He said, you do know you're going to spend the rest of your business journey fundraising. And I didn't, but he was right, you know. So, you know, that was tough. Did a great job getting to profitability, but then we took on the UK and that was way tougher than we expected. And although we got great traction, we did £1 million in revenue in the first year, you know, of this advertising, 90% gross margin revenue. But we built an organization that was designed to do 4 and 5. So quick and all, as we pared it back, it was just difficult. And with the credit crunch, it just became impossible. We went to Canada. I've told you the story about Canada. So then we go into the deals business. But I think from 2006, roughly, to about 2015, there's about a decade there, which, oh, it was almost a lost decade. You know, it was just a constant dogfight. You know, I remember walking around City West with my co-founder, John McDonald, one of the co-founding team. And John had been with me. He was with me in Green Isle Foods, and he eventually came over to Pig's Back, and super, super guy. But John thought, you know, we're in trouble here, Michael. It was September the 11th, 2014. He says, we're in trouble here. He says, look, we're really just beginning to struggle on the working capital. He said, I'm not sure I can see my way through this. Look, we need to think about this. And I said, well, let's discuss our director's responsibilities here. You know, at what point do we call it? You know, what are our options? And John was exhausted at that time. Now, the story changes. He was just exhausted from this journey at the time. And I soon realized that, you know, I had the energy to keep going then, you know, and John hadn't, you know. I remember calling a few other members of the team together. I said, look, come here, we've just got to just get together. We've got to come up with something that gives us one more chance. We called it Project Encore, which was to get our encore, you know. And John ended up at the time leaving the business. He got a good break. I didn't know whether he'd ever be back or not, but thankfully things started to go well for us again. And John, after his break, came back in.
What did you change? What was Project Encore?
Project Encore was a project that basically said, we're going to have one last look at the costs in the business. We're going to look at some of the costs. There were a few costs that related to the shareholder base. So we were probably wrong to say we were paying our chairman, but we were accruing a fee for our chairman. We were paying monitoring fees to a UK investment group who had invested in us. There were a few other costs sort of that I said, look, these have to go. All of these have to go.
How do you get rid of them?
By agreement, to say it's either this or nothing. This is the only show in town. If we're to survive and give ourselves a chance to create shareholder value, these must go. You know,
quickly explain monitoring fees, because it's only something I was reading about this week. When a company will take an investment in you, they actually charge you. So kind of explain that just really quickly, because I think it's an interesting point.
You know what? It's reasonable while things are going well, you know, and it's reasonable while things are on the up, you know. So we were very grateful to have this company called Hotbed at the time invest in us in the UK. Now, they were actually like a club of investors, but the Hotbed company found the deals, did their due diligence on the deals, but the investors then invested directly themselves, but it was monitored by Hotbed. Okay, so their deal with us basically was they'd take a fee on funds raised, but they'd also get a monitoring fee. So they would continue to work on behalf of their investors and they'd report back to them.
And what are they doing? And they're monitoring you. What are they doing?
Well, they basically wrote reports about how Michael was missing his targets consistently.
That's what I'm trying to ask. Like, you know, it sounds high level, but I doubt it is.
Well, I mean, you know, in fairness to them, they tried to add value, but it was very difficult in the credit crunch times that they were.
What are those fees, like monthly, quarterly, yearly?
Yeah, they'd attend our board meetings. They'd write up reports for their investors. They'd appoint a non-executive director. You know, they tried to make introductions, those sorts of things.
But they're charging you a continuous fee for having done that.
Which we were like, I mean, listen, when you're being offered, you know, 4 or 5 million, whatever it was at the time, you know, you're very, very grateful to get it. You absolutely need it. And, you know, that they're asking for whatever it was in monitoring fees seemed utterly reasonable at the time. But when you hit the rocks, those reasonable things are no longer reasonable, you know.
So went back and were like, look, we're scaling everything back. Is this or nothing?
We looked at everything. Everything again. I mean, we thought, you know, look, you do a round of cost cuts, you think you're there. You know, you come back out of 3 months later, you realize you're not there because your processes have changed in the meantime. And there are other things that you could look at cutting, you know. So there's, you know, it's a continuous process. And, you learn so much about how to derive efficiencies within an organization. And you learn to apply those. But Encore was that final set of cost cuts. It was the sale of Empathy Research. And it was also an agreement that I kind of demanded of our shareholders to say, our staff have shown massive commitment and forbearance. If they hang in with us and we make this work, they must be among the beneficiaries of what happens. So we cut a very good deal, what turned out to be a very good deal for our staff in terms of their shareholding.
So did you refinance the business here essentially?
No, we didn't refinance. There was no new money in, no. Okay. But we basically said, look, the share option scheme we have for shareholders, they're all underwater. It's useless. So we, whatever it was at the time, maybe 17% of the shares, equivalent of shares in options. We said they all have to go, but they need to be replaced by a scheme that will give the senior managers an incentive to stay right now, because we were down to one technologist, our CTO, and he was made an offer that he felt he couldn't refuse. I said, no, you're going to have to refuse it. You know, you are going to have to refuse it, Paul. And he said, well, talk to me. So we showed him a bit of love by way of a retention bonus, but we also promised him some significant equity. And I made the same promise to my senior guys, you know, and they in turn.
It's not an easy sell, significant equity in a business that ain't exactly flying. That's not an easy sell.
Really good point. It's a really, really good point. They were prepared to buy it. I mean, you know, look, you know, they were all, I mean, how many times did people buy Michael's optimism? But this one last time, I was proven to be right, you know.
I swear, I've changed. It sounds like an absolute grind. I'm nearly emotional listening to you. I feel tired just listening to this journey.
Well, Gary, there's a guy, a friend of mine, Noel Hayes, he read the book and he said to me, jeepers, Michael, he says, I nearly ended up in John of God's reading it. How you didn't, I do not know. And you know what? I look back and go, I do not know. But let me go back to the bit about Johnny Mack. So Johnny Mack got his break and he came back into the business. By the time we came to exiting the business to Secret Escapes, which is well out there at this stage, I was exhausted. I was literally exhausted. I could hardly get myself over the line. And guess who had all the energy? Johnny Mack. Yeah, guess who's in there still running that business on behalf of Secret Escapes? Johnny Mack. You know,
when did you exit the business?
We exited the business in February 2019.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was gone by the year end.
How did the exit come about?
Well, I actually got a random email from a guy called Jean-Charles Lacoste. And I saw, would you believe this? My God, I actually binned it.
Wait, hold on, spam.
I was doing a quick filter of my emails. I said, oh, this is just some fella trying to sell me Lacoste, you know. And then I said, well, Lacoste, maybe the guy's in the goods. You know, we were doing a goods, we had this guy still do a goods marketplace, you know, which became a big feature of Pigsback under a guy called Dave Food. He did an amazing job developing this goods business to compete with Amazon. But I said, oh, maybe it's Lacoste clothing or something that Dave might be interested in this. And then I read it and he said, no, I'm representing a company called Secret Escapes. They're an upmarket travel business who sell hotel packages to people in Britain, Germany, Spain, and they were interested in selling their packages into Ireland. They could see Pigsback being of use for that, but they also could see that we had the upmarket hotel packages in Ireland, and they wanted to bring those to an international audience. So, you know, he presented it initially as a kind of a commercial partnership that we might do. So I rang him and we had a great chat, bit of it in French.
Talk to me, Johnny. You know?
And he says, Michael, would Pigsback be interested in selling their business to Secret Escapes? And I gave the right answer, Gary. Do you know
absolutely
what that is?
Not. Never.
Absolutely not. No. And by the end of the conversation, I think I might have said, well, look, I mean, I suppose everything has a price.
Send me over a ridiculous number and we'll talk from there. Yeah.
So we arranged to meet two weeks later in London. And I went over there and I had arranged a meeting with another company who we had been sort of flirting with, if you like, you know. And I met Alex Saint, who was one of the co-founders of Secret Escapes, and another guy called Tom Valentine, the other co-founder. And, you know, ostensibly the meeting was about a commercial partnership, but it soon became fairly obvious that it was about an acquisition. So again, the question was, well, will you entertain an acquisition? I said, well, you better talk to me about price parameters because I'm not going to waste any time, you know. And, you know, we were ready for it by then because we'd gone, you know, we had sort of made that big jump. There was no way we were going to keep up those growth rates. We knew the market was stagnating a bit. We were, I wouldn't say at the time we were fearful of Brexit, but we were fearful of the unknown, you know, anything. And we were too used to the unknown banana skin around the corner.
Plus, you're just shy of, you're 20 years in the business then?
Yeah, exactly.
I was in, chunky, like.
Literally in my 20th year, and that wasn't the plan. I was supposed to be in the Bahamas after three, you know. I never wanted to go there, I can assure you. But anyway, later that day, I met another company, and, you know, we were interested in buying their Irish wing, and they were interested in merging with us in Ireland, maybe, you know. And I said, look, lads, you know, I can't say anything, but, you know, you're going to have to sort of, you know, show a bit more interest here, you know. And we ended up having two players at the table, and when you have two players at the table,
key,
you've
got
a better chance of getting it. Yeah, far better chance of it. I mean, I think we got a full and fair price. It was more valuable to them because they're a bigger international company and they'll get a higher multiple on everything. So it made a load of sense for
Sequence. Well, it's like what you said about your acquisitions. You know it's going to pay off in this way. Right. They've crunched the numbers. Precisely, they're not fools. Gary, yeah. Was it revealed how much it sold for?
It was. It was revealed in the end that it was 25 million, you know, which was a chunk of money, you know. I mean, we could only have dreamt of that years earlier.
Ask everybody this question. I get varying answers.
Yeah.
What did it feel like after you closed? So everyone has an earnout. So talk to me about what it felt like the day after it closed, during your earnout, and then the day you actually finally left.
Being really, really truthful with you, I was probably too deep in my anxiety, and it was just relief. I there's a quotation from Pele after I think it was 1972 or something like that, World Cup. It was his third World Cup and Brazil won it. Now, somebody might correct us on that, but in and around that. And somebody asked him, what did victory mean to you? And he said, it was just relief. You know,
that he finally won it.
You know, to have won it sort of, you know, for the people who were hanging off him or were dependent on him. But also the prospect of, for me, moving on as well, you know. Anita Roddick, you may remember
body
the
shop.
Name. Was Anita, super, super woman, body shop woman, yeah. And a really progressive thinker who died all too young, but she wrote about the sort of nature of entrepreneurship. And I remember reading this in the 1990s and, you know, taking it in, but really it was only years later that it really struck me what it meant. She said that entrepreneurs are very obsessive people. Mm. They're excessively engaged in their business. And when they're excessively engaged in something for such a long time, that separation creates a void that is often filled by a bit of depression.
Yeah.
And I don't mind saying that I certainly suffered from a bit of that. You know, it took me, I mean, that first, I don't know, year, 2 years to really feel right about myself and in myself. You know, we had the launch of the book last week and Gareth Lamb was there to MC it and John McDonald said a few words and we had a bit of music and lots of our old friends and supporters and shareholders and whatever not. It was a joyous, joyous night.
Nice.
But, you know, I was ready for it.
That was the night you didn't have 3 years ago, say.
That's it. Yeah. Exactly. You know, there were nights, but they were me going through the motions, you know.
I appreciate your honesty because I ask everyone that for a reason, because, you know, as entrepreneurs and founders, you know, you're like, why am I doing this? What is driving me? You know, and for a lot of people, it's like, oh, the end, it's the end. And there's this cliche about you have to enjoy the journey because the end point is not where you're actually going. And that's true. And as you get older, you realize all the cliches are true for a reason. And I like exploring this with people because I try to kind of like break this down to understand it for myself and for other people going, you know, the end mightn't be where you're actually heading. You know, you might be heading there for a different reason. And maybe where you are right now
Oh, yeah.
Why you're actually doing it. It's the journey. It's the love. It's the game. It's playing the infinite game.
I know you'll appreciate this, but I call the book From the Arena.
Yeah.
And the reason I did was I've just always been very taken by Roosevelt's famous speech. It was called Citizenship in the Republic, but the most kind of well-known passage is known as The Man in the Arena, you know. And he delivered the speech in 1910, I should say. So I remember, you know, there's a lot about it around 2010, the centenary of the speech. It was appearing here and there, and various people have made things of it. But as I read it, I actually have it here in front of me. But as I read it, and you might permit me to read a little bit of it, I couldn't help but being struck by the parallels between this doer of deeds that he talks about, the man who is embracing, it was all the man at the time, so forgive us, it just is what it is of its era, but the man who was embracing great enthusiasms. You know, that's us entrepreneurs, you know. But he wrote, "It's not the critic who can't, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat." It's invented for us, for
it's
us entrepreneurs.
So powerful.
You know,
who knows neither victory nor defeat,
and
who lives in the middle.
And we stumble and we fail and we make idiots of ourselves and we make terrible mistakes, but somehow we get up again because we have to get up again, you know. I've always had this kind of, this sort of almost romantic idea of entrepreneurs, because I have a great regard, always had a great regard for the risk takers. You know,
that's why I love doing this podcast. I get to sit down with people every day and learn a little and just explore and try to figure it all out, because it's a wild game.
Yeah. And as I said to you, actually, you know, one of the great joys since exiting the business has just been spending time with startups, you know, and it's frustrating and they stumble and they fall and they fail. You know, I mean, I know that there's nobody going in with greater realism than me, you know, and I honestly do not expect to make a profit on my startup investments. You know, there are one or two of them are very good, and who knows, you know, actually one or two of them are quite good, but there are one or two of them, one has failed. There are others that may fail, may not fail. I don't know, you know, but they're wonderful people. By and large, you know.
But that's about this podcast. Like, I'm doing this and I know it's going somewhere magic. I said this to you over breakfast. I know there's something big coming here. Yeah. I couldn't for the life of me tell you what it is.
Yeah.
But I know in 5 years, we'll be having a coffee and I'll be like, look, it actually turned out to be this.
But this is your great devotion. This is your great enthusiasm.
And I've learned to relax a little. Yeah. I was very uptight, very wound up, like very stressed out, like yourself. I've gone through highs and lows, even my most recent business, like massive highs and lows there. And again, like yourself, struggled with my mental health massively as a result of that. And it was only when I learned to relax and go, this is the infinite game. Mm. Play the game. Stop being so obsessive about the destination. Mm. Stop trying to retrofit from the back to the front. Mm. I said, you've sat down with 100 plus people now. You know that's not how the story goes. Mm. Stop chasing a linear progression and just learn to relax.
My father-in-law used to say, business is not built on rail tracks. Superline.
Beautiful.
Superline.
Stealing that. Instantly, that's gone in my pocket. That is, it's never linear. But it's mad though, Michael. We continually fight against our own psychology because we try to be linear.
Yeah.
Oh, A plus B equals C. Yeah. And that's why I love getting people like yourself on, who will sit down and over an hour and 20 minutes, will break down the realities.
Because, you
know, I never give people advice anymore. I'm like, I don't know, just talk to me. I never give it because I'm in no position to give it. I'm like, that's why I love doing these, because I can put out 100, 200, 300,000 episodes and go, you need advice on that? I've just the person. Go back to episode 263, Michael Dwyer. Wow. That's the man that'll solve that answer. And that's how I think about it now, because we spoke with Ian Brown yesterday, head of NDRC, and we were talking about the global, you know, the global talent available to us now. You know, instead of getting, oh yeah, Jimmy's down the road, you get him. Instead, they were able to get the CEO of Stripe to come in and talk to them.
Amazing.
You know,
amazing.
And that's how I look at the podcast.
What an ecosystem there is in Ireland, you know, that
it's
we can
getting
draw.
Better.
And
it's actually, getting better. What,
like when I get involved with the startups, you know, it's not as you say, it's not my advice, but it's my ability to draw the right people in to particular situations. You've a SaaS sales challenge. Well, let's bring this guy in who used to work on Pig's Back, and he's now working with HubSpot or Salesforce or, you know, whoever it is, or, you know, let's bring this communications person in, you know, et cetera, you know, that's important. But, you know, we talked earlier on, and I think it's kind of relevant at this juncture, but I don't know if they still do it, but the Catholic Church used to make us all do these pre-marriage courses.
Oh, we do. We did one. It was understand? A surreal experience. So we got married 5 years ago, and I was mad into the business at the time. I was working every single day, the cliche thing. And the course, I think it was like 4 or 5 weeks that in the evening. And I was like, is there any way of speeding this up? The entrepreneur brain. Yeah. And my wife found this thing. We could do this half day on a Saturday with this lad out in Dundrum. And I was like, perfect. Done. And he was the oddest fish in the world. He wasn't even a big fan of marriage. Into this dingy room over some office in Dundrum.
I'm not a great fan of a lot that has gone on in the Catholic Church, but I think that was one of their better ideas, because you know, marriage is a lifelong commitment. It's a blooming tough thing. So if somebody's kind of highlighting to you the level of commitment that you need to be showing over the next decades dash the rest of your life, you know, that's no bad thing. Likewise for an entrepreneur, you know, I think it's one thing for you, Gary, to say, I'm going down this entrepreneurial path. It's really important that your partner gets that, is supportive of that, but also understands the very likely extreme ups and downs that are going to come with that. Now, I was very lucky in that regard. My wife, Karen, is of a business background. We met through Jacobs many years ago. We went to France for that period. But she was, she had studied marketing. She loved new ideas. There's an entrepreneur in her in no uncertain terms. You know, I see her even with Nikki, with Drobi. She's quite involved there. She should be termed a co-founder. She's that involved. But you know, there were sustained, really difficult periods where I'm sure her belief was waning. I'm sure it was. But you know what? She hung in and she gave me the benefit of the doubt that we'd eventually get there, you know. And when I came in and said, you know what, I know this is going to be particularly difficult, but we have to sign a PG for something, you know, which I hated doing. I did not. It was a rule of mine. I'm not signing PGs.
What is that?
A personal guarantee. Do not sign personal guarantees. I remember walking out of Anglo-Irish Bank because we were looking for some funding. They said, we'll give you funding, but you've got to sign a PG. I said, let that be.
Anglo and the lads. They love an LPG.
Out we went, and thanks be to God, out we went. But the trouble I'd have been in if that happened, you know. So I said, no, I'm just going to keep. I'm going to have to find new investors. I'm going to have to find new money, you know. But at one point, our chairman, Kevin, offered us a short-term loan on condition that I do my bit, which meant PGing a small extra overdraft facility. And it was essential, you know, and that happened just a couple of times. But I'm going home to Karen. You know, you can't sign those things without telling your partner. That's not good news. You know,
it's not good
news for a relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not cool. No. So I'm going home to Karen. I said, look, you know, I hope this is the end of it. I think it is the end of it, but we need to sign this, you know.
Yes, what was dear. That putting you on the hook for?
That was 75 grand. But it was, you know, but it was 75 grand on top of every investment round. I felt the need to sort of show my support and put an extra bit in. Initially, it was larger sums. Eventually, it was smaller sums, but it didn't matter because the sums were becoming more and more marginal. You know,
it's the signal as well.
It was like, you know, it was a time when obviously my income was quite restricted by the performance of the company. And look, just by the nature of things in Ireland, everybody's asset-based property values, everything were down, you know. And then we all got these tracker mortgages that were far too easy to get. And I was still an interest-free by the time I sold the business. First thing I did was just pay off my mortgage. Second thing I did was take care of the fact that I don't have any pension, you know, because I had accrued money within the business for a pension and it had to go as part of a fundraising.
You read my mind. I was going to, as you were speaking there, I'm like, I'm going to ask him, did he do anything wild with the money? So, invested in a pension.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, look, I mean, I've been very, very fortunate. No, there's nothing wild. I still drive my 152 Volvo XC60, you know, and I'll get another few years out of that. I'm not a bit interested in that. The one thing we did do was buy a townhouse in Connemara in Clifton. Nice. And we love that. And we love escaping over to that. And we love having family and friends over with us when we're there.
Beautiful.
And, you know, it's been great. So that's it. But, you know, I've been quite heavily involved in startups, supporting them, and love the energy coming off my own daughter, Nikki, and her sister, Ella, has come back from Australia and she's jumped in as COO. So she's a co-founder now in Drobi. And my eldest daughter, believe it or not, Kerry, is in Swoop in London, Andrea Reynolds' company that funds startups.
Yes. God, they all got the bug off you.
I love listening to the stories there of her own progression, but also of the various founders she meets and the startups she funds. And, there are Swoops now, there are NDRCs now, you know. I saw a picture outside of the Grand Canal Dock with the Bord Gáis Theatre, the Marker Hotel, all the apartments and retail spaces that were there. When we launched from the Ocean Bar, which is on the far side.
I know, it's been about a million things. It's been rebranded 100 times.
And there was nothing except that big industrial red chimney that peaks up from between the Marker apartments and the Marker Hotel.
Yeah.
That was the only thing that was there. Over to the right was Harry Crosby's house. And this area, we were told, was earmarked for development for a theatre and a hotel and whatever. You know,
if you just had put all your money into that, you would be...
Digital docs, Oh, God, I'd have hated that.
Be wildly rich. But isn't it mad though how fast and how slow things change? Like, we used to live, literally, we lived in a barge in front of that.
Ah, wonderful.
That was where we lived, until five years ago.
I passed it the other day and I saw quite a few barges.
Yeah, that's where we used to live.
A few other people have had those ideas. I said, well, you know what? Wouldn't that be a hell of a solution?
It was. Not easy, like yourself, though. Not easy. They do not make it handy for you to pursue alternative things. Yeah, we lived in that for 4 years.
Yeah.
Bought it, lived on it. Again, you're talking about supportive partners.
I'll give you a great story.
Try sell that to my wife. That was a big sell, but she embraced it fully.
Well done her, and that's fantastic.
It's transformational. Honestly, it's been transformational for us because I was starting one of my businesses at the time, and I was like, I just literally did a back of the napkin. So on a notepad, I always have a notepad with me wherever I go. I just wrote down, right, what are all my outgoings and like biggest rent by a mile? I was like, right, one blank page, figure out how to make that zero. And tried everything. I was like, you know, those guardianships of properties. I looked at like tiny homes, looked at building houses and roofs of warehouses. I looked at everything wild. And the boat was the most straightforward solution because you could buy it, you could move it if it didn't work, and you could sell it very easily. They retained their value. Bought a barge down in Athlone, refitted it because she was like, if we're going to do it now, we'll do it right. I was like, if you agree to this, I'll refit it exactly like a studio apartment. So ripped out, it slept 8 when we bought it. Like, there was beds everywhere. Ripped it all out. It was horrible looking. There was pine. Ripped it all out. Painted it beautiful white, minimalist, flat screen TV, L-shaped couch. Made it properly and then just sailed it up to Dublin. And what I hadn't really fully told her is that I didn't really have an agreement or permission to be there. So we just literally sailed it in one Monday afternoon into a berth in Grand Canal. And about 3 months later, they finally caught up with me and they're like, how long are you here? And I was like, I just can't remember. If I'm honest, yesterday. I'm here a while, I think.
I've been coming and going.
You get to the master of the nothing answer, coming and going, I'm moving around. He's like, all right, okay, we'll have to figure out something. And that was it.
Wow.
That was it. And then 4 years later, we were there.
Do you know something? You're a very good company. We met a lady called Hazel Hutchinson who in London, and she helped us raise the money that we raised. But she then introduced me to a couple of fancy entrepreneurs, you know. But one of them, Simon Woodruff. Pretty certain that was his name. He was the founder of Yo Sushi.
Oh, yeah.
But we met him on his barge on the Thames in London.
See?
You know?
Do you know where I really got the idea? Really it was cool. Branson. That's where I originally got the idea. I am a massive Branson fan. His first book, Losing My Virginity, was the first business book I read that truly transformed how I thought about it. I thought business was boring and dull and, you know, you had to work for a KPMG or something like that. And instead I read that and I was like, oh, that's it.
Well, I remember coming off Woodruff's barge and saying to Hazel, I mean, it's cool, Hazel, but with all his money, I hope he has a house.
Yeah. Oh, it's tight. Like we had a little puppy. He grew up. He was 2. We moved off and it was magic, but it was damn hard, but it was magic. But now we're both kind of looking at each other the other day and we're like, it's nearly time for another mad scheme, isn't it? Mm, it's nearly time. Right. We've kind of recharged. Yeah. You talked about startups there. What kind of startups are you interested in?
Well, I suppose I've probably learned a few lessons from what I've done. I'm mainly focused now on SaaS businesses. Mm. I mean, you know, there are a couple of these that are, you know, have advanced very well. I mean, probably notably Eddie Dillon's Credit Logic. It's a super business. They've done very, they supply the what I'd call the plumbing for not just mortgages, but loans of any description, you know. So they've persuaded a lot of the pillar banks who would have been very nervous about doing any such thing to embrace the cloud, but via their secure infrastructures and whatever. And his challenge now is basically to scale that internationally, you know. So that's no uncertain challenge, but these guys are probably up to it. Bounce Marketing, so that's the research business that now has a SaaS-based platform that is headed up by Charlie Butler now, originally founded by Brian O'Mahony.
And yeah, Charlie's a great guy. Lads.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's got huge energy. And Ronan Dowling Cullen. I probably got it wrong, but something like that. That's what he gets for having a double barrel name. It's not my fault. But Charlie and Ronan are two very good guys. There's one I'm meeting later on, a guy called James O'Connor, who is actually of my vintage, but he's been working on a dog tracker. So this is basically a tracker that you'll attach to the lead of a dog. And it's a fantastic thing. It's like a guardian angel for pets.
I mean.
So it'll tell you, you know, the dog's movements during the day. It'll give you a Strava-like output in terms of, you know, your dog's movements today, over the week, over the month.
I
compare that to the cohort, your dog's friends, community, etc., etc. You know, but it'll do things like, you know, it'll detect itching, it'll track temperature, so it becomes an indicator of your dog's health as well.
I love that. I literally said to my wife the other day, I was like, my dog's name is Odie. I was like, I wonder, is there like a whoop that I can get for Odie?
Yeah.
That he can wear and he can get tracked. Yeah. You know, he can track his, you know, his behavior and his movement. He's my best pal. It'd be easy to track his movements.
Wonderful.
If I'm at home, he's there.
Wonderful.
He's under my feet or he's beside me. So like I'd be in. Whatever James is building, I'll sign up straight away.
And I take our dogs up to Killiney Hill for a walk occasionally, you know, and off they go because they can roam up there.
Yeah, it's fine,
you know. But we often wonder, like, you know, we're doing this linear track, you know, and they're going off, boom, zigzagging all around. What kind of steps do they do up there?
Yeah.
Where do they go? How far away for us do they actually go?
My mate James does mountain running and he brings his dog Poppy with him, and the odd time a deer will appear and Poppy's gone.
Oh, wow.
And he's had like times where she's gone for like an hour or two. Yeah. So he had to get like a little tracker.
Yeah.
So now it's a little tracker that goes on.
Well, the trackers are difficult because they have to, you know, they have to have GPS enabled, you know. So your little sort of Apple tags and things like that, they'll only work within your phone range. They're no use.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
So this is very exciting. One or two others, maybe. Frankly is a business that's based out of Sligo that does a people management and employee engagement platform.
Okay.
And has some very good clients. It's a very robust product, very, very good product. So, you know, they all have their challenges, but they're exciting businesses. God, who am I going to be in trouble with now for leaving them out? But anyway, look, there's a range of these that are. There's one I must mention, Sociolocal, that I just got involved in relatively recently. This is a one.
What's it called?
Sociolocal.
Sociolocal.
Michael and Stephen, the two guys who are running it, but. It supplies, I suppose, what you'd call chains or maybe franchise operators with a social media management solution that allows them control it at the center, but leave room for local differentiation. So the brand manager at Centra can put out a campaign to all Centra stores, but there can be a little bit of local customization by the local guys. So it ensures brand uniformity. It ensures regularity of messaging. It ensures the national message gets out there, but it allows for that bit of customization.
That's important.
And
these
guys, they had their challenges. They've been through a SCARP process. This is the new administrative process, which had it been around, God, we'd have been tempted to go through it probably as pig's back, really tempted, you know. They've gone through that. They've had supportive shareholders who've helped them come out the other side. They've pivoted into a SaaS-only business now. And I would predict that they will be very successful.
Nice. So there's your tip for today.
They're all very good businesses, to be honest with you. You know, now they're, you know, they will not all succeed. You know,
that's just, be highly unlikely. But look,
exactly. Right. By the way, I didn't mention the failures, and I won't.
We'll go into our quick fire round.
Right, out the way.
Usually, I ask people, if you wrote a book, but you already
have. I can't remember that question. So just fire away.
First book. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
a book called Classic Wisdom for Modern Managers, which you probably have not heard of, not many people are, written by a lady called Jocelyn Davis. But she delves into the classics, the old books, including the Bible, the Quran, Jane Austen, Shakespeare, all of those things for classic wisdom. And then she draws parallel between that wisdom and modern management challenges. So there's two great things about that.
I like that.
The wisdom for managers, but the classics in their own right. And if it wasn't that book, I would have said Moby Dick.
I like that. I'm a big fan of Ryan Holiday. He talks about Stoicism, meditations by Marcus Aurelius, and he kind of makes that accessible for a modern audience. So that sounds very similar. Classic wisdom for modern managers. I love that.
Yeah, and Moby Dick. Don't forget Moby Dick. Listen, the whalers, they go out on their voyage and they lower the boats where they actually, they've got the big ship where they basically store the whale oil and, the skins and whatever not that they're going to sell when they eventually get back to port. But the little boats go down to actually, what's the expression? Was it lampoon or something like that?
Yeah, harpoon, I think, yeah.
Thank you. Is it was it harpoon? Harpoon. Well done, you. So Ishmael, the first line, a great line. I'm Ishmael, whatever it was. But from the moment I read that line, I'm just kind of drawn in. And this fella on his mad whaling journey.
I haven't read it in years, actually. You've prompted me now over summer to get back.
The absolute fear, their lives are in mortal danger when they're out there in these little boats, taking on the whale. But when they get back in and they're on safe ground, suddenly they're missing it.
It's like you in the business.
That's it. Yeah.
Very similar. So it's not a surprise that you like that book. Yeah. You've written a book. What one piece of advice would you give to any aspiring author?
Don't do it. Be ready for a big, long slog, and try to get maybe work with good people. I had a great editor in Gavin Daly, and I enlisted the help of a guy called Carlos in Argentina to help me with the KDP side of things. That's the Kindle Direct Publishing, the Amazon side of things, because a lot of formatting, design, etc. involved. And I had a good cover designer as well in Charlie Dardis, and also Brian O'Mahony helped me on a few things. So those, enlist help.
What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
I don't know. I think I've been privileged, hugely privileged. I wouldn't put it in those terms. I think it's a privilege to do what I've done despite all the challenges, to get through the challenges, feel that sense of relief at the end of it. I'm just going to call it a privilege.
What would you do if I give you 10 million euros today?
Right. That's interesting. I mean, I couldn't help myself but put more money into startups, I'd put a lump of it into Bitcoin. It's scarce. They're not making any more of it, unlike those dollars and those euros and that fiat currency that's out
there. I'm on board. Okay. So
there you go.
If you weren't an entrepreneur, what would you be doing?
I might have gone down the academic route, maybe lecturing, that kind of thing. I would have liked that. I love meeting young people and just, talking to them, trying to give them some encouragement, trying to explain concepts, whatever.
If I give you 1 million euro today, but the stipulation is you can only invest in one company or one person, who would that be?
Oh, gee, I'm going to fall out with several founders here.
Do it. Do it.
Oh, gee. Sociolocal don't need it. Waggy needs it. It's risky, but it could be amazing. Probably put it in Waggy.
Okay, Waggy. What is something that people will be surprised to know about you?
I play a lot of poker, and I played poker intermittently during the journey. And it was one of those things that was it demanded your full attention, and therefore it allowed you to switch out of the other things you were in. So last year, obviously after the launch, I could afford to indulge myself a little bit more. I went to the World Series of Poker, played the main event, and I was the top paddy, which means
nice.
Among the 50 or 60 Irish, mainly professional players, I was number one. I was 200.
I asked you, did you do any cool things with your money? That's the answer.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's the answer. Yeah, I was 257th out of about 8,500 or something like that.
Wow.
But this is the one that won't be beaten. I mean, these guys are all better than me, but you get a result occasionally, But the online version of the WSOP came up, and a friend of mine said to me, he said, Michael, do you know the WSOP is now, the online version is on, I didn't know. And he said, the main event is coming up the weekend. So I went into my PokerStars account, GG Poker account, and I had 100 and something euros. This is a true story. It's an incredible story. But, you know, I, young people out there, do not embrace poker. Be careful unless you really know what you're doing, you know.
Terms and conditions apply, blah, blah, blah. Absolutely. We'll put an explainer. Plow on with a cool story.
So for my $100, I entered a satellite. And one in 50 people were going to win a seat to the main event for $5,000.
Yeah.
And I won a seat. And they plunked me straight into day one. And I ended up on day one, fifth out of whatever number there were. And in the end, again...
All online?
All online, yeah. So a week later, you come back, or a few days later, you come back for the final day, you know. And I mean, I was like, you know, really anticipating this, looking forward to it. And I, my chip sank because I just wasn't getting any cards. But I was really ultra patient. And eventually I started to get a run of a few hands. Oh, gee, I should remember what I got knocked out anyway. Oh, I think I was 57th out of 5,000.
Wow.
Something like that.
Did you get a payout?
Oh, a big payout, yeah. I got, like, from my $100, I ended up getting $54,000, you know, which is lunacy.
Yes!
I know.
Yes!
Now, look, come here, paid for a lot of sins, you know, and I'm still feeding off it, in fairness. So I'll go to the World Series of Poker again this year. I might, you know, I wouldn't see it as an annual thing.
But I can't believe we got to nearly the last 2 minutes of the episode and you tell us that gold.
No, I love poker. Poker allows you compete aggressively.
Yeah.
In a really focused way, it demands the most of your sort of your strategic capabilities, your tactical capabilities, your psychological reading capabilities, all of those things. And there's a world of learning in it. So yeah. Like, I mean, compared to the pros, I know so little, but I know I can apply what I do know fairly well when under pressure, and that's helpful, you know. So yeah,
that's a gem of a story. What do you believe that other people would find strange or disagree with?
Actually, I struggle to answer that question when you
yesterday's guest said he believes Brexit is going to be okay. That's that kind of stuff.
No,
so
I don't,
so,
I don't,
so go as wild as you want.
I don't believe that. Oh wow, give me the question again. Sorry, I will then find an answer for you.
What is something that people, and sorry, what do you believe that other people would find strange or strongly disagree with?
I don't know. Next question.
If you could have anyone as a co-founder, who would you want?
Wow. I was extremely lucky with Johnny Mac. We just, you know, it was yin and yang. You know, I was the yin, he was the yang. So, like, I mean, I'm full of my optimism, overbrimming, and he's saying, come back here, you know, I wouldn't change that.
So you'd get the band back together.
Wonderful, yeah.
That's a good answer.
Yeah.
What's your final bit of advice for every entrepreneur listening?
I think, look, if it's in you, do it. But do it with your eyes open. Expect the long haul. Recognize you don't know the unknowns, and there will be unknowns. And be ready to evolve, and evolve again.
That's brilliant. Thank you. What is the name of your book?
It's called From the Arena, An Entrepreneur's Journey.
Where can we get it?
Based on my journals. Amazon, don't buy it from amazon.co.uk because for some stupid reason, they haven't got it listed. They have a merchant selling it with €30 delivery price, so don't go with that. Amazon.fr, it's fairly priced and it's very quick delivery. So amazon.fr or on, it's available on Kindle. And I kind of recommend the audiobook. Went to a lot of trouble to do the audiobook with the podcast studios. And I've had lovely feedback on it. And by the way, sorry, for any early stage entrepreneurs out there, any entrepreneurial students, I have put aside a good few audiobook codes for a free copy. So, you know, you don't have to pay the 20 quid or 15 quid or whatever it is, you know.
We'll do a giveaway. I'll launch when we launch this episode. We'll do a giveaway of a couple
absolutely.
Of codes.
Absolutely. So I'm happy to give you 20 codes, you know, to people who they're interested, they're very welcome to it.
Brilliant. Michael, thank you very much. Been
very
a privilege.
Well. Thank you very much, Gary. Privileged to be here.
Hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Wherever you're listening, whether it's on Spotify, Apple, or YouTube, click subscribe and there'll be a brand new pod in a couple of days. I'll see you then.